My name is Marco Iannacone, and I'm optimistic about the future. Especially for the work that I do, I'm always inclined to look into how to make the companies that I'm dealing with and I'm serving grow. And it's always very fulfilling when you did this together with somebody else.
My name is Alexander Kuttlich, and I'm optimistic about the future of tech investing in Europe. I have to be optimistic, because every time we invest, we do it because we believe something positive will come out, otherwise we would not invest. So I'm optimistic by job design, but I'm honestly really optimistic about where our industry is heading.
The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
Welcome to The Optimist, presented to you by Tech by Handelsblatt. My name is Felix Seltner, your host, and I'm excited to bring you an unusual conversation today about money and tech. Our guests join us from Berlin and from Munich, and I don't think they would have shown up on a podcast together just a few years ago, because they represent two very different worlds of money. Corporate finance and banking and old money on the one hand, and venture capital and risk-taking and young companies and young money on the other. They are Marco Iannacone, Head of Client Solutions Germany and member of the Executive Board of Hypovereinsbank and UniCredit Bank, one of the most valuable banks in Europe at the moment, and Alexander Kuttlich, Founding General Partner at 468 Capital and one of the most prolific German tech investors. And Marco and Alexander found each other because they realized that they need to help successful European entrepreneurs to take on big checks. And I'm talking 50, 60, 70, 100 million euros. And they can only do that together by explaining to people who have money to invest that it is okay to invest in technology in Europe, that it makes sense, that you can trust these entrepreneurs, that you will make your money back and much more than that. And they bring to the podcast how they do it. And also they claim that in a few years from now, we might see a very different technology landscape in Europe with much more bold, big investments and much more courageous entrepreneurs who stayed on the continent and did extraordinary things. So here is, for an injection of optimism, an unusual conversation about money and tech with Marco and Alexander. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
First of all, Marco, I have to ask you about a very specific urban myth, because you're Italian and you live in Munich. I lived there for 10 years, and the people around me, the locals, always claimed that their city is Italy's northernmost city, that Munich would actually be a part of Italy at heart. Can you, an Italian who lives and works in Munich, once and for all clear whether this is a fair claim?
Well, I don't know if it's a fair claim, but a lot of people here seems to have close affiliations with Italy, especially on Lago di Garda, which is not too far away from Munich. And everybody loves Italian food. Quite few people speak Italian, which I suppose has also something to do with the fact that they like my home country. So actually, I think you're right. So Munich seems to be the northern city of Italy.
Wow.
I actually like it. It makes me feel a bit at home, yes, when I'm here.
The Bavarians go as far as saying that the Lago di Garda is actually the southernmost Bavarian lake. But that's maybe a different conversation.
That's probably a little overstretching, but but definitely they like it, and we like it too. So we have a lot in common.
And Alexander, where are you joining us from today?
From a city that has very little to do with Italy. I'm calling you from Berlin.
Is that Alexander, what you call home?
Yes, I call home Berlin now for exactly 20 years. I moved to Berlin in 2005 for my very first proper job. That's now exactly 20 years ago, and it seems like I will most likely not leave anymore.
And you're here today to talk less about Italian food, which I would love to spend a podcast on, and a little more about finances and the sort of perspective of Europe in that context. And I think it's by now a known fact to everybody who's listening here, to all of us in this tech community, that there is no shortage of ideas. There is no shortage of ambition, of entrepreneurship, even IP, intellectual property, when it comes to new technology companies being put together, started in Europe. But Europe seems to fall short every time when the moment comes to write a really big check, as we say in the US. We still actually use checks. When it comes to the moment to write a big check for a promising startup. And I would like to invite you both to rant a bit here in the beginning. And yes, this is the Optimist podcast, but let's rant a little bit. What is the problem? Marco, I would ask you to go first.
So one issue here I see is that Europe, the financing processes here are not necessarily synchronized with the growth that is in the DNA of a startup. And what I mean is that sometimes there is a disproportion of size, but also of the understanding. And so I think as financial institutions, one of the things we need to do, we need to learn faster where the value is when you look into a company that, because you call it a startup, but we also have a lot of companies that are not necessarily startup. They are much smaller probably than the one that you're used in the US, but they are sizable and they grow very fast. And in a fast-growing company, what is needed is not necessarily the same set of tools that the bank can offer when you're looking into a stable, big but stable type of economic reality. So in the US, you have a much broader and deeper venture capital ecosystem, which is what normally you would use to finance, especially at the beginning, startups, and you have decades of allocation from different type of entities in this type of space. Whereas here, we have an issue, and now I think this issue is becoming more and more, let's say, urgent to be solved, which is that we need to catch up for about at least 25 years. So, and it's not only financial institutions, but it's also the political intention and goodwill there to go into the direction of creating a competitive landscape that can allow this company to develop and to grow. Definitely banks have a key role there. But again, I think here the key word would be speed and understanding.
So you're saying the banks, your peer group, your industry, they're not fast enough. They're not learning fast enough what's needed for these fast-growing companies. You're saying the ecosystem that needs to be there to foster a landscape of young technology companies is lacking. And you're also saying the problem is we are by now 25 years behind. I mean, that's a lot. Alexander, what would you add? What would you say is the problem? Why Europe is falling short when it comes to, you know, really supporting its young companies?
Yeah, I think so Marco put it very right. If you take into comparison, you know, this ecosystem that we all admire, the Silicon Valley ecosystem, they just have the simple advantage. They started in the 1960s. So they have, I would even say they have 40 years of a head start. You know, our ecosystem really only started in the 2000s. And when the first bubble burst around 2000, you know, the investors, LPs and VCs and their LPs already made good returns in the US. So they made money. They saw that the asset class works and they took a small hit, but they just carried on. And in our case, here in Europe, as we all remember, the ecosystem was in such an infancy that this bubble not only led to a small hit, but to a huge drawback that almost an entire generation of investors burned their fingers. And then really, it took a very, very long time to recover. So I think my reading is we have almost everything. Yeah, so we have a number of like really great entrepreneurs. We have great early stage capital, enough funds. So every good entrepreneur that is looking for money typically is now capable of raising the first 1, 2, 3 million. So if you look back 10 years ago, we had a big discussion around the early stage funding gap, and that's all resolved. And now it's really about, you know, taking the next step. And my positive reading of that obvious problem is that it's just a matter of time.
Interesting, Alexander. So can you maybe share with us how you do that when you speak to a big institution, a big fund these days? What do you tell them? What's your elevator pitch to them that helps them understand, yes, it's okay, it's good, it's helpful, it will make you successful to invest your money in European startups and take a lot of money into your hands and not just that early stage, not just that little money?
If you zoom out a little bit and look left and right, so we have a very well-established early stage venture capital industry. So we have many, many very good funds that give an entrepreneur the first 1, 2, 3, 4 million. So that took a long time, but it's well established. And I would say that we don't have a problem. And then at the later end of the spectrum, so if you talk about private equity buyout funds, you also have, I'd say, a very, very good selection of very good and large funds that would, you know, finance a buyout of a large established company. Just this piece in the middle. So when we go out and fundraise, we don't not only have to convince investors that 468 Capital is a good fund, but also we do have to sell the entire basically growth capital industry. I would say a couple of years ago, you still had to sell venture capital. So people thought venture capital is a bad asset class. I think we now are beyond that point. There's enough evidence to show that venture capital, if done well, is a good mix in an asset allocation. And we have also now, I think, crossed that point where, you know, people said, okay, maybe venture capital is good, but European venture capital is bad compared to US venture capital. I think also on that side, we have now enough evidence from multiple reliable sources that actually, if done well, European venture capital also is at least on par with US venture capital. And it's now really about explaining that growth capital, you know, not providing the first 5 million, but, you know, the 50 to 100 million that a company needs to really scale, that's an attractive, or maybe the most attractive piece of technology investing. And you could, on the one hand, say, you know, the investor that puts in growth capital has typically businesses that are much more mature. So you have faster time to liquidity, you have a lower loss ratio, and you can a bit choose your risk appetite a little bit more according to, you know, the characteristics of the company that you see, right? There's just much more to see and much more things to look at, and there's much more ways to manage your downside risk. So you can say it's a good asset class, but secondly, it's also a good moment in time to start looking to that asset class. You know, I think if you've done the same thing, if you started investing in growth capital in 2020, most likely you would have, you know, probably invested in inflated valuations. So I think we're coming out of a couple of years with very high valuations. And if you compare the time today, I think we have never had more good companies raising growth capital. At the same time, many of those players that would provide growth capital in the last years, just think of the large US crossover funds or of, you know, the Eastern Sovereign Wealth funds that invest a lot directly in Europe, they are nowhere to be seen. So there's much less capital, I would say, ballpark around 10 billion euros a year that is missing now every year in financing those businesses. So if you take those things together, you see it's, assuming that you now understood that, you know, growth is a good asset class, it's also a very good point in time to start looking into that, since, you know, competition or supply and demand has shifted very much in favor of the investor.
But Marco, that sounds so simple, what Alexander is putting on the table. You have a more mature company, you have a lower chance of losing your money, you can choose your risk appetite, you get your money and more money back quicker when you invest in a company that is growing. And I mean, even to me, who is a journalist and by no means run a fund, that makes total sense. So Marco, you said to me, preparing for today's podcast, you said, well, there is a gap between those who have the money and those who have the expertise. So what is the misconception here about this gap?
Generally speaking, you know, there is this conception that startups are not interesting for banks yet. And I think that's a very major misconception. Mm-hmm. But one thing, when we're talking about learning, it's both ways. So imagine that within a bank, you do need to develop those skills to understand the risk differently. So one of the main jobs of a bank is to manage risk and evaluate risk. So in a company that is has a very fast growth trajectory, the cash flow is not necessarily the only indicator you need to look into it when you want to evaluate the potential, but also the risk of one of those companies. So in a way, and this is, for example, what we do with Alexander, no? So we are learning from those companies and those venture capital that have a very long and successful tradition in the sector. And we are taking that learning curve internally in our models, for example, no? And then vice versa, because sometimes when we are having discussions, I have to explain also to Alexander the way we are looking into things. And sometimes they need to adjust to help us to help them, right? Because it's never like a black and white. And I give you a very practical example. When we are speaking about Europe, we do have a very large network of investors or different kind of investors in different jurisdictions. So when I need to convey an idea to someone, I have a very large audience, if you wish, right? Which is very helpful for companies that are supposed to be, for example, going international, because it helps if you're partnering with a bank like us. Because we are a credible partner, no? Especially when you're thinking about going international. And how did we manage to somehow build that the skills internally? It's a lot of work, obviously. And it's also not something that we have started the other day. It's over 10 years that we built, and not accidentally in Berlin, our tech team. According to official statistics, we have like 75% of the 200 most funded tech companies that have been supported by that team over the years. So looking at a language which we are used to, which is what you can call a market share, yes, we are a very, very large player when it comes to tech. And that's why, for example, it's relatively easy to deal with us, because we do have that understanding. And somehow, just to give another indication, about 90% of the deal volumes, if I look at the KFW statistics on a venture tech growth financial program, have been somehow initiated by us. And I will mention only a couple of them. I mean, we have Delivery Hero, which we have been basically in every capital market transaction with them in the last 8 years. We have done quite important transaction with Zalando, with Flix Mobility and HelloFresh, just to mention names that people know because they're very popular. And now that the speed is becoming exponential, well, it's not getting easier, yes? So you need to put even more effort there to to be able to keep up the pace with companies like the ones that Alexander is dealing with normally.
So Marco, what I hear from you is, yes, there's a problem, but we at UniCredit, we're not necessarily part of the problem. We're part of the solution. But also your market capitalization might help. I'm reading 81.7 billion. So there could be a few checks around 50 to 100 million that you can write in the future. And I'm wondering, what are you learning from Marco, Alexander, when it comes to speaking his or his team's or his institution's language that doesn't match, Marco said, naturally with the VC language all the time?
Yeah,
No, I mean, it was very interesting to hear that UniCredit is almost a hectacorn, put in our language. No, I mean, we have been working with UniCredit or, you know, the German HVB, I mean, for many years. Marco mentioned a couple of the names. In my first life, I spent almost 10 years at Rocket Internet, and already back then, practically all of the large transactions we work with UniCredit, and now, of course, it's 468. It's continuing, and not only as a banking partner, but also as a partner to many of our scaling companies. And I think, as Marco put it, we are coming from a time where the worlds were very far apart. You know, the world of startups was very far away from the world of the real money. And the world of the startups was also very far away from, you know, some of the largest, you know, large customer base of HVB in Germany is the mid-market. And the mid-market companies 10 years ago, they couldn't care less about what venture capital funds would do, right? And then startups, well, 10 years ago, we had the choice of investing into online pizza or online shoes. And you just couldn't get a lot of interest from neither the world of real money or the world of real industry to be interested in selling shoes or selling pizza online. And now, I would say 10 years later, the worlds are coming much, much more closer to each other, because startups that used to be small, pet startups are now suddenly huge firms. You know, the names that Marco mentioned, I think everybody knows on his smart home uses Spotify, or all the shoes in Zalando, or, you know, orders a pizza and delivery here, or sells his car on Auto Eins, or, you know, it's real large companies. I mean, they're not yet as large as businesses in the US in most cases, but I think we have gone a very, very long way. And I do see that those worlds are coming much closer. And with regards to UniCredit, what we can learn is, you know, the translation, or the, you know, bridging and translating that they have helped us, you know, to see how institutional investors look at our asset class and what metrics they use, you know, to basically compare what we do towards other asset class. I think that was very important.
Like what? Like, do you have an example for something that Marco helped you on and then you had success out of a sudden?
Yeah, I think ultimately the most important thing is people need role models and they want leadership, right? So entrepreneurs need role models. They see successful entrepreneurs. They see Oliver Samba, or they see an Elon Musk, and they want to be as successful. And that's why they start companies. In the world of money, in the world of LPs, you know, you don't get fired to write an LP investment into Fund 9 of Blackstone Infrastructure. But, you know, as a big institution, if you start supporting less established firms as a banking partner, as a partner to scaling firms, I think that gives automatically, you know, it gives a leadership and a role model to many other players in that same, from that same universe. It suddenly says, okay, if UniCredit spends time on funds, if UniCredit spends time on tech companies, then there must be some business to be made, right? It's not about, I mean, of course, we all want to see Europe being successful, but ultimately it's not about donating money or, you know, supporting a non-profit organization. It's ultimately, it's about doing good business. And I think what we have benefited most from that firms like UniCredit are role models and, you know, and show leadership in taking our industry seriously, both from the, you know, company, technology companies, but also from firms like ours that start and scale and of course need support from professionals.
I have to say that, and I'm not saying this because we are in such a podcast, but Alexander and the reality that he represents is a role model for us. When somebody like UniCredit joins a reality like 468 or Alexander and the ecosystem that he represents, and we are taking this combination on our network, that's where the magic starts, because it's not only the venture capital. There are many actors there, and today, way more than in the past, that are interested in investing in like companies or realities that proved to be for the future potentially very interesting, economically speaking, but also in terms of having this vision for the future. And I'm referring to wealth management customers, family offices, institutional clients. So it's not only the venture capital. So a reality like us, we can use the leadership of Alexander to teach and to introduce this specific asset class to a vast or a relatively broad group of investors that would then operate or allocate part of their capital into this specific asset class. And again, imagine what they are looking for. They are not looking for high yield only or a safe investments or a capital gain. They also like to learn. And one of the things that Alexander is doing very well, very, very well, is actually, and I think it's a super smart idea, yes, to allow those potential investors to enter into his world. He's teaching them, he's showing things the way that, it takes years. Alexander, you have at least a couple of decades of leadership in your sector, yes, at this point, even though you are young, but you started very early, right? And that's very rare. That's very precious, if you wish, right? So imagine that on one side, you have those group of investors that like to have opportunities, but they are lost because that's a complicated world. The technology is complex. And then you need someone that is representing the reality from a financial standpoint, meaning UniCredit, partnering with someone that is an expert and allowing that, exchange of views in a very safe environment where you get to learn who the real leaders are in that sector. And I think that's the beauty of it. So, and that's actually what I think, if you wish, we've been brave enough to do in the last 10 years, or more.
Yeah, and it's an interesting image. I just wanted to bring that image up again that you just painted for us. So you're, as UniCredit, you represent a financial reality to people that trust you, invest in you, have known you for a long time. And you create a safe space in which you invite people who do not know about what startups do, what venture capitalists do. What I hear is that you're building something, and you're building something that puts learning at the center and has a solution to the problem that you phrased in the very beginning as the outcome. Alexander, is there something you would like to add to what you're building at the moment? It sounds really interesting. To me, it sounds like a learning journey for people with money into a new world that helps them make more money, but at the same time helps Europe to finally have a complete tech VC ecosystem.
So I think if you look at Europe technology and growth, you see that compared to other very established economies in the world, there's just too little or much less exposure to technology and growth on a per capita basis. So for some reason, the institutions that typically in other markets would invest into technology and growth are doing that to much lesser extent in Europe, even though there's a lot of evidence that it would make sense. There are a couple of ways to help move more capital into technology and growth in Europe. There are political measures, but that's above my pay grade. The only thing I can do is, help educate potential investors why it is an interesting field to spend time on. I can't, or we can't, force anyone to invest, but I think it's what we learn. It's a lot about the market education. We see with many of those very smart financial institutions, they just have spent very little time on technology and growth, and they are lacking maybe a bit of hand-holding to understand the asset class. I think that's what we in partnership can do well, is, to just explain potential investors why this is an attractive space. And I think that's where I think the combination of UniCredit and us is good in kind of accessing an audience that they, just spend time on understanding the attractiveness of technology in Europe. know if it means if they invest now, if they invest into 468 or invest into one of the many other good funds. You know, that's really only a second goal. It's now really to make sure that we educate decision makers within financial institutions, you know, potential LPs, to spend more time on technology and growth in Europe.
If this dream of yours, where you're saying, you know, the mature companies, out of a sudden now, they have the chance to grow and they have the chance to get the money that was lacking for such a long time, what would actually happen? So maybe you can paint an image for us. How if you could choose, how big would a fund be for these mature companies to grow, first of all? Like, what's the size of euros that we're talking about here that you would imagine or hope for or wish for? And secondly, what kind of companies would you actually see rise that are maybe a little stuck right now? So can you paint that image for us?
I think that image, if you scroll five to 10 years into the future, you will see at least half a dozen funds of several billion in size, just tackling or supporting European technology growth companies and provide them 100, 200, 300 million tickets to grow. Those funding rounds are happening. So I think the best companies already today have access to that capital. It's just not coming from local investors. And you might argue that's not a problem. Money is money. You know, as long as those domestic companies get capital, it doesn't matter if it comes from the UAE, from Silicon Valley, or from Europe. You could argue they already get funded and we don't have a problem. So, but if I, you know, the picture that I see is the fact that we have local capital, and I think many of the international funds have not invested too well in Europe. Yeah? So there's even a couple of articles stating that, you know, many of the US or Eastern funds have misunderstood the landscape of European companies and often went after some shiny objects that ultimately were not the best businesses. And
like what?
Yeah, I mean, we all know that a lot of money has gone into sectors in Europe that are not really, were not technologies at the core of a business model. You know, BT, you know, electric scooters, a lot of, you know, delivery firms. And we have also done a lot of that in the past. But I think if you now look at at the current technologies, I think we are entering into a decade where finally technology is back at the core of investing. You know, when venture capital was originally invented, it was designed to pre-finance technology. Then we had 20, 30 years where venture capital was used mostly to pre-finance marketing, you know, where we took money to help companies scale, and we look very much at marketing economics, you know, how much money do you put in for customer acquisition, how long is the customer lifetime value. That's all, I mean, many very good businesses came out of that, but I think we're now entering a decade where technology is back at the core, that you actually use venture capital or growth capital to fund technologies. And I think the landscape already today of companies that are seeking capital is looking vastly different. So you have, you know, a lot of defense tech companies raising capital. You have a lot of AI companies raising capital. You have, you know, companies doing space tech raising large rounds. I think that's new, and that's only because we have a very healthy early stage landscape. And I think if we have more local capital, I think the more money you have locally, I think there's a case to be made that local growth capital essentially creates a more efficient funding market, and that also the investors who have a biggest stake in the company also have a stronger say in the strategic direction, which then should translate into the fact that those businesses will also leave a bigger piece of the value creation locally. Yeah? So I think if you have US investors, it's not black or white, but sometimes it will lead that more of the value creation actually happens abroad, as opposed to if you have mainly European investors on the cap table. I think there's a stronger tendency to keep some of the value creation locally, which ultimately also fosters the ecosystem even further. But again, I think we larger funds would probably not lead to a dramatic increase of new companies. I think that's already good enough. So we see good companies. I do think it will create higher ambitions, you know, both from, you know, scaling size-wise, but also in terms of what technologies people actually dare to touch, knowing that they will raise a lot of, will need a lot of capital. And I also believe that it will lead to a larger chunk of the value creation as staying at home.
So you're putting this image forward then that different to now, where the big successes also that Marco mentioned, Delivery Hero, Zalando, Flicks, HelloFresh, I mean, these are all, as you say, they're, you know, it's not deep tech. I mean, this is a network of buses that I can take, or I can order a sneaker online, but they have been very successful with consumers. You're saying there will be a shift in the future to much more complex things where you need a longer arc of understanding that this might pay off.
I think what is important, I think we needed this decade of marketing-led e-commerce and SaaS companies to establish the ecosystem and to have entrepreneurs being very successful. So I think that was a very important and very positive decade or two decades of businesses that we participated a lot in those business models. So it's not about basically saying that was a bad thing. It was a very important thing to create the ecosystem. But now very often, and I'll give you one example, of one of the companies, so an entrepreneur, we backed his first company and he was building an Amazon FBA aggregator that was not successful. And then his second business, he started a company called StarCloud, where he's basically sending GPU clusters into the space where, you know, we have 24 hours of sunlight. It's called, you know, it's data centers in the sky, which is, of course, much more ambitious from a technology point of view. But he became more ambitious as a repeat entrepreneur. So you have to see an ecosystem really something that iterates over cycles, over fund cycles, over entrepreneurship, you know, successes, role models. So that's a very natural evolution of starting with something with lower barriers to entry and then gaining the self-confidence as an entrepreneur, but also gaining the self-confidence that you can actually tap into enough capital to touch something more ambitious. And now we have now arrived at a point of time where we have 10 different interesting technologies to pick from as an entrepreneur, as an investor. And that's a very good thing. It doesn't make things easier as an investor because you suddenly have to understand more technologies than just software. But it's, I think, overall, as we discussed before, it's much more relevant for industry. So there's not a single company in Germany where suddenly technology is not touching their core. You know, and 10 years ago, I said, you know, I find it interesting, but it doesn't touch my core business. And today, I'd say every business in Germany somehow is affected by technology. And that's why it's, and I do see that also in basically in the audience or in the customer base of Marco, that many of the clients that UniCredit serves suddenly show much greater interest in technology, and it's real technology that's today at stake. Yeah.
Marco, when you listen to what Alexander is painting for us, this image of ambition, of more complexity, where do you see the role of UniCredit in this ambitious future? Let's do an exercise with you as well. Let's scroll forward into 28. And let's say the funders in Europe by then get the funding without leaving the continent, without taking it from the US or other places. What has happened structurally, culturally, financially at UniCredit since May 2025, that this is now happening?
One very good thing and very important thing Alexander said today, technology is touching everyone. It doesn't matter if you are on a steel mill or on a tech company, the technology is everywhere and you must understand it. There's no option not to understand it, right? As bankers, we are using artificial intelligence to do a lot of things, right? Even though not necessarily all of us understand what that means, but it's here. And it's very practical. So what I think we do, we use the skills we have built looking forward as accelerator and facilitator of growth, making sure that those skills are both at the service of investors, but also of corporates.
You're obviously working together closely, and it's a little bit like a love story to have you both on a podcast, because you're obviously moving into the same direction and you're building something that, if it has success, will help a lot of people learn and eventually make more money for everybody involved. What is something that you disagree on?
When we met the first time, you know, I was thinking maybe Alexander is a little too cowboy. Maybe he was thinking I'm a little too conservative. But not because of the way we dress up, yes. But the language we are using when we introduce each other is not naturally the same, right? But it took very little to understand that we have a lot in common. So sorry to disappoint you, but I can't come up with anything better.
I'll ask the cowboy.
Like, what we disagree is on the required depth of due diligence. I think that's maybe a natural
fair enough
disagreement. But and honestly, I think, look, you feel that UniCredit is, of course, a huge institution. But if you look at the pace of growth, and I think there's so many similarities on the degree of ambition on how to basically transform an industry or to tackle opportunities, you know, new markets, new growth opportunities. I think that's we're very much aligned, even though, you know, we are several hundred times smaller. Yeah, and I think that's really for us, the cliché is, you know, UniCredit is representing one of the oldest industries in the world, you know, the industry of money, you know, and we are doing the opposite. You know, most of our businesses are, you know, a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of months old. And that's a natural difference. But I think what we have to do as a fund is to try to understand their world a little bit better, their language a little bit better, you know, helping UniCredit navigate in that world of technology companies that also look much different than 10 years ago. I think at first glance, it's like a big cliche of two very different companies. But then if you sit in the same room, you actually notice that we look at the world in a very, very similar way. And and mainly talk about opportunities, seeing that, you know, the technology is already an established field, but we are still very much in the beginning. Yeah, I mean, us for sure as a firm, we're still very early, but I think if you look at the penetration of technology, also the penetration of technology investing, we're still in the infancy.
To close us out today, I have two questions. One is, for people who are listening and who are themselves aspiring entrepreneurs who are maybe thinking about what you said, Alexander, of being ambitious, being bold, maybe they're thinking right now is a good time to start my dream that I have about space or this AI idea that I'm walking around with. And they are now more optimistic than they were before listening to this podcast, which is our goal with this format. What would be your advice? What would be your advice to this aspiring entrepreneur listening right now?
Everything I've learned from entrepreneurs is the longer you wait, the less likely it is for you to start. And most businesses actually fail before even reaching the starting line. And that's why my recommendation is always to start. Very often between then taking the decision and actually launching or becoming successful, very often the business model changes along the way. But most people either wait too long and then opportunity costs increase, real costs increase, you know, complexity, also hunger. And so that's why when I've really seen many entrepreneurs wait for years for the perfect moment, for the perfect idea that rarely comes. And in most cases, they do regret not to have started earlier. Yeah, I mean, still you have to have a very strong bias, or you have to be almost crazy to do it, because statistics always will tell you do not start, because most likely you will fail. But maybe if you fail in the first instance, you will be successful in the second or in the third. But or very often, we have seen people leaving their jobs in consulting or investment banking. They start a business, it doesn't work, and suddenly they go back to their old employer, they get a much better job because they have learned real inside knowledge about technology, which they would never have acquired if they hadn't started. Yeah, so start with the right motivation. Start because you see a problem or because you see an opportunity. Don't start because of the lifestyle or because of the willingness to make money, because then it won't work. So I think challenge your own motivation. But if you have a real reason to believe that it's the right moment, don't wait.
Wow, that was almost a complete seminar in entrepreneurship right there, Alexander. Thank you. Marco, anything to add for aspiring entrepreneurs listening right now?
Well, I would have intuitively, also looking at the experience that I have, answered, like, do not wait. I don't think any dream should be like subject to waiting, if because you put it in that way. But at the same time, and this is not valid only for entrepreneurs, as a banker, I think it's the same thing. Yes, you need to feel uncomfortable. I think one of the issues nowadays is that we believe that being comfortable is the right way to do it. Me personally, I always look for the hardest way to get something. It's a matter of principle, but it's also the way that if I look backward in my, at this point, almost 30 years of experience in banking in more than 10, close to 15 countries. The challenges I was facing, it was always very much worth it after, meaning when you do it, it's not fun, when you're uncomfortable. But then when you look backward, you definitely have zero regrets. And I think not starting something you really want to do, it will probably lead you to have regrets, which I don't think it's a good thing. So personally, I would simply suggest just go ahead, do it. Life is too short not to fulfill your dreams, or at least to try very hard.
Tech by Handelsblatt is debuting in a few days in Heilbronn, gathering European leaders for the first time. And the dream here is to build a cluster of optimism. And these are really the words that you see on the website, tech-europe.org. It's the cluster of optimism. And Unique Credit is co-initiator of this gathering. So co-creating this new community of European leaders that you both are a part of. What is the best that could come out of this first gathering for both of you? Alexander, please go first.
Yeah, the best is really a tech optimism. That a shared belief that technology is something positive, and that we remind ourselves that in Europe, Germany especially, has always been a high-tech nation. So the reason why we live in such wealth is because we always were a high-tech country. We invented cars, we invented mRNA vaccines, we invented GLP-1 drugs. So we are a constant source of technology. Technology is something good, and it's a source of the growth and the prosperity has been technology. And I think it's sometimes that people forget about it, and many descendants of entrepreneurs that 100 years ago invented cars or other entrepreneurship endeavors do not allocate enough capital relative to their sources of wealth into technology today. Yeah, so I do believe that if we remind ourselves that the reason why we are where we are is because some people in the past put money to work to create and finance technology, that we should not stop doing that, and that we have to allocate more capital into growth and into technology, and because that's what brought us here. And if we want in 100 years' time to be equally important in the world and living in such a prosperous environment, we have to keep seeing technology as something positive and be optimistic about what it brings to society and to business.
Tech optimism coming out of tech. Alexander, thank you. Marco, the final words are on you. We went from Munich around the world all the way to Heilbronn. What would you like to come out of this gathering?
Well, another example of being brave entrepreneurs, because that's the first edition. And I still remember one of the first meetings in which we were discussing the idea. we said, well, let's create this you know, big tech ecosystem in Europe, starting from Germany. So we believe in Europe's future. Look, both as a global economic powerhouse and a leading hub for digital and AI-driven innovation, going back to the point of Alexander. And our purpose is to try to empower communities to progress, delivering best-in-class solutions for all the stakeholders and really unlocking the potential that our people and our clients, we believe, have across Europe. And the Tech Conference by the Andesblatt creates this high-impact environment where we are bringing a lot of very bright minds like Alexander and visionary decision maker to discuss about the future, right? Remember what you asked me at the beginning, what I'm optimistic about. I'm optimistic about the future. That's one step toward the future.
Marco and Alexander, thank you so very much for being guests on The Optimist today.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.